pandemic got us into a reflective space and made us look inward to see what we can do for the world at large. As a self-expression coach, I became a catalyst for women and started Vani, a one-on-one coaching program for women on finding their voice, to speak up, to be visible. As a storyteller, I spotted there were many ordinary people amongst us leading extraordinary lives, making a difference to the world, and they needed to be heard. Thus was born You and I with Rashmi Shetty, where amazing personal journeys with their uniqueness and individuality are showcased. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. Guest today is the inspirational Madhura Dasgupta Sinha, the founder and CEO of Aspire for Her, a unique startup to motivate women to enter and stay in the workforce. Madhura has been a banker for the last 25 years, holding leadership positions in IDFC, Standard Chartered, and ANZ Grinlays Bank. She completed her MBA from XLRI and Electrical Engineering from the Jadavpur University. Madhura was one of the 12 women across India to be awarded the British Chevening Scholarship in 2003. Since its birth on Women's Day 2020, the rapidly growing community at Aspire for Her has become a movement for women in India and across the world, getting together members, supporters, and mentors to unleash the trillion-dollar potential in the Indian economy. Madhura's work has been covered widely in the media, including CNBC, NDTV, BBC, The Times of India, New Indian Express, etc. Aspire for Her has been honored by awards from UN Women, Economic Times, T-Hub, NDTV, and International Advertising Association. Madhura was among the 23 of 23 list published by the HR Association of India. She also is invited to speak at various prestigious forums, including IITs, IIMs, Niti Aayog, G20, UN Women, Global FinTech Forum, National Commission of Women, and many acclaimed podcasts. Aspire for Her is proud to be part of the first ever cohort of women founders launched by Google India. Listen in as she shares her journey, her motivational moments, and what keeps her so positive all the time. Hi Madhura, I've been behind you, chasing you, and finally get to meet you and talk to you. This is truly an honor. Welcome to You and I with Rashmi Shetty.
Rashmi, the honor is absolutely mine. And thank you so much for bearing with my incredible schedule. And finally, we are meeting here today. Delighted to be doing this with you.
Likewise. But before we get to what Madhura is today and the amazing work that you're doing, I want to know what little Madhura was like. To the Madhura Dasgupta Sinha that the world knows you today as. So can you take us back on your story?
I think I've been fairly similar in my entire journey. I think my path has been fairly linear. I was born in Kolkata and I was blessed to have two incredible people as my parents. My father describes himself as the strongest feminist in the world. And I think from a very early age, I saw that he encouraged, motivated my mother to put her economics degree to good use. And she went on to joining the civil services, first at the state level. And then she went on to become an IAS officer. And that was all thanks to my father's not so gentle pushing and motivation to ensure that she did something meaningful, created an identity for herself and did not just be content with being somebody's wife and mother. Wow. So I grew up in a fairly empowered household where gender roles were unconventional. And that's how I sort of remember my early days. I went on to do engineering, and then I went on to do an MBA, which I feel are fairly linear paths for somebody who was growing up in our times. And I had a great time doing both of that, and and then went on to be the first. I think there are three parts of my life. The first 25 years was just sort of education. The next 25 years was my life as a banker, and I think the next 25 years is going to be probably the most exciting, which is my current avatar as the founder and CEO of Aspire Printer.
Oh, wow. I like the way you've divided it. Now, all things said and done, our first 25 years definitely play a role in the way we choose, the way we move ahead. So I assume from a household like that, you definitely were a very brilliant, bright student who went on to lead your class, or at least were in the top 10 percentile of your class.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely meaningless to put ranks to the work that we do, and the learning journeys that we have. But I was very privileged to have a lot of wonderful teachers, a lot of wonderful mentors, I do remember that when I was in standard 12, and I've not actually spoken about this anywhere, I got a relatively decent rank in the state, so I was 13th in the state, and our school was very well known for producing toppers at the state level, and my husband and I happened to find ourselves in two consecutive positions. There were two people who were 13th, and he was 15th. So it was really, really a sort of a quirk of fate, So I did land up putting an incredible amount of I think weight behind academic success, and it seems fairly meaningless now, frankly. But those were the times. I think families like ours or societies like ours put a lot of weight on academic success, academic brilliance, and I think it's absolutely, absolutely meaningless, frankly.
Meaningless or not, Madhura, what drove you at that time? Because that was the only thing, or were you an all-rounder good at many other activities, school and colleges?
Not really, not really. I think what drove me even early in school was really relationships. I loved having a bunch of friends, and when I moved schools at a young age, I was growing up in a small place called Asansol, which is about 3 hours away from Kolkata. And then I as I went into Calcutta, I think the first thing that made me feel very sorry was to leave my friends behind. And slowly I grew a sort of a network in Kolkata as well. And we had a fairly multicultural kind of childhood because my father was in the railway, so we would keep traveling, and we would go to lesser known places. And he decided when I was in the 7th grade, he decided that he would go to Ghana, a small country in West Africa, to help build their railways. And the Indian Railways was basically sending a project team there, and he was part of that. And my parents took a very unconventional decision to say, our children will go and stay for 3 months, be homeschooled for 3 months, miss their annual exams, and just kind of hang around in a new country, getting to know a new culture and new people. I still remember the letter that they wrote to the principal, and a lot of people were shocked as to how can you get them to miss school for 3 months and homeschooling for 3 months? Are you mad? But my parents were like that, and I'm very, very grateful for the kind of exposure that got for us, because it completely changed our worldview when we saw a new country, new continent, and we saw a lot of Europe as well at that point in time. There were very few, I think, families who were blessed as ours, to be able to see a lot of Europe, to be able to see a lot of Africa, and not to mention other parts of Asia as well. So one of the prime memories that I have of that point is when I was 13 years old, I was coming, we were coming back, and it was a long journey from Accra, Ghana's capital, to Mumbai at that point in time. And then we had to go back to Kolkata again, where our grandparents were waiting. My parents decided not to accompany us. So it was my sister and I. And I was 13 and my sister was 9, and we came back alone, and we spent 24 hours at Zurich on the way back. And that it was one of the most empowering, I think, trips that we had. And like I said, I had the best to have very, very unconventional parents who were very bold in many ways.
Bold in many ways, and today it has shaped you to take unconventional paths as well. But after the first 25 years, this superb 13th year of your life, which is actually a year, 13 they say is a year when a lot of decisions about what how you're going to move forward happens, because you're in your eighth standard at that point of time, a crossroad kind of a section of your life as well. And did your parents inspire you to take up engineering, or just because you were a brilliant student, you just followed the rest and took up science and moved into engineering?
I didn't really have any passions about engineering or otherwise, but that was a thing that you did at that time. My parents actually had absolutely no say in my taking up engineering, but it was a lot of I wouldn't say peer pressure, but a lot of peer conversations that drove me to it, to say, hey, this seems to be the only way forward, and it seems to be a cool thing to do. And that's the reason why I took up engineering. But it isn't, it wasn't a very easy journey. And today also, I don't think it's a very easy journey. It does take quite a lot of hard work, including writing a bunch of competitive examinations, and then scoring some marks, and then finally finding your way into a good engineering college.
Yeah, true. But you know, there's something about engineering colleges, because I've met so many people who have the basic degree of engineering but are doing something totally unrelated to engineering. So what is it about engineering that allows you to think so wide, think so different, and not conventional?
I was speaking to somebody the other day, okay, and in New York, and I was explaining the Aspire for Her model to her, to say, this is how we work, this is the model that we have, and this is the mindset change model, and it's called E cubed is equal to MC cubed. And she stopped me and she said, are you an engineer? And I said, guilty as charged. She says, the way you define even basic social constructs and social transmission theories of change, it shows that you're an engineer. And I said, guilty as charged. And that is exactly how I think. But it has helped me in my thinking process, in my algorithms, in my mind, and how I put structures to possibly anything and everything that I do. So yes, it has shaped my thinking, and it has shaped my view quite a lot, my engineering degree, though I don't use it at all.
No, I think your foundation is engineering, like you said, structuring everything, because very logically you moved into finance as well, the banking industry. You did your MBA in finance, or how did you move into the
No, I
banking?
actually did it both in finance and marketing. So XLRI allows you to sort of be multifaceted, if you like. So I love marketing, in fact, and I liked finance. But banking seemed to offer me a sort of a decent intersection of both, especially retail banking, which I would grow to like and pursue. So therefore, I just went into, but completely a banker by accident. I didn't really have a lot of strategy. If you know, B school placements are very cruel, and they have a very very strong and a very stringent sort of a path, right? You have all of these companies which come in, and you have this concept of day one, day two, day three, day four, and it's important to again have a day one sort of a slot and sort of make it there. Again, completely meaningless paradigms which we are driven by for so long in our lives, but that's how it was, and you know, you just sort of get along with it and just flow along. That's what exactly I did. So I didn't really know whether I would like banking or not. It turned out to be a wonderful career choice because I think banking is one of the most fulfilling careers in the world. And I just happened to amble into it and find my way, and also find my niche within banking.
Okay, so again, you said by accident. Now, going to the first 25 years of your life from the second part of the 25 years, if there is one advice that you would give the 18-year-old self, what would it be?
I told you about you know, the rank that I got in the higher
right.
secondary examination, and there was a bunch of reporters who actually came to my house. Okay, and I was 18, and they asked, you know, what is your vision? What do you really want to achieve in life? And there was only one thing that I said. I said, I want to do something for the women of our country.
Oh.
And you know, I had absolutely no clue as to how I could do something or what I would do or how this dream would take shape. But that was probably a very early, you know, sort of enunciation of something that I truly wanted to do. It was a very latent sort of a dream at that point in time. As I was, you know, going around in my career and, you know, and as I was turning 50, I always had this niggling sort of a, you know, if you will, a sort of a push in my mind to say, what have I done? You know, I had said to that reporter that I will actually do something, and that was a public sort of announcement to say that I will do something. It's like as if telling the world that I want to do something about this problem that our country faces. So what have I really done? And it was a feeling of guilt, which was also propelling me to sort of stand up and do something, because I felt that I had truly let my 18-year-old self down by not doing anything for the women of our country.
But looking back, Madhura, what prompted you to say that? Were your growing up years where you saw women not being empowered enough, or because you had a mother who was completely on her own and a household where women are completely encouraged to do what they want to do, aspire whatever they want to have? And what made you feel you saw people outside and saw women not getting their due that you wanted to make a difference?
Always, always. So so we would discuss it at home to say, you know, this is a woman who's brilliant and, you know, hasn't really, her potential hasn't really been unleashed, her potential hasn't been leveraged. And my father and my mother would have conversations around these. Also, as I went abroad and I saw many different countries, I saw many women in other countries, you know, whether it was in Europe or in Africa. I saw that women had a certain joy de vivre about them. And what I would see in India, and somehow, you know, it would come back to haunt me multiple times to say that, you know, women were almost being trained to be demure. Women were almost being trained to not have a mind of their own. And that used to bother me a lot. And I think a part of it was, of course, internal, but a lot of it was also external, seeing all these women in other countries where I was seeing that. And this was just general, right? It was not that I was sort of looking for a story or anything like that, but I was seeing that they were a lot more empowered. They felt it felt that they were a lot more independent. They were taking their own decisions. They knew their mind. They were getting angry. I was seeing a lot of women in our country do not get angry. So that was what was bothering me. And so that was what, I guess, you know, led to many dinner table conversations. But again, as I said, that I did very little about it till I turned 50.
So somewhere the calling was very clear at that age. And life had its plans for you. You went into banking. So then we are now in your second phase of 25 years. And in the banking sector, if you notice, there are women comparatively at senior positions also. If you take it as a corporate element of our society, then yes, in the banking sector, there are a lot of women. So having been there in that sector for 25 years, what do you think makes women far more visible there in comparison to other areas of corporate?
Actually, they're not. So, you know, there are two layers of women in banking. One, absolutely brilliant, who received a lot of support, mentorship, sponsorship, etc. And they have gone up right to the top. You know who they are. But there is a huge middle rung where you don't find too many women. And there is, of course, the bottom of the pyramid where, again, you find a lot of women because they join banking. They feel that it's a great career option for women. And it is. But even today, and if you see the total numbers in our country, you know that women's workforce participation has been coming down from 2005 onwards. So when I joined the workforce, actually things were better. It was an upward trajectory, and it has been a downward trajectory for a while. I am hoping that this year's data will show us some positive glimmer of hope, but it has been a downward trajectory. So therefore, with all its wonderful perks and organizational dynamics, while banking is a fantastic career option for women, women have not really swarmed to banking or gravitated towards banking as much as we would like them to be. So there is this huge middle rung, which is absolutely empty. And there are women at the top, there are women at the bottom.
Oh, so it's just like any other corporate sector.
It's just like any other corporate. We as bankers haven't done a good job in actually leveraging the huge untapped potential of Indian women, among the best and the brightest in the world, and a fantastic career option for them is banking. But we as bankers have not really done enough to get them into this career option.
Okay. And was this the reason why you came up with the name Aspire for Her? I want to know how it was born. How did the name come about? Because I love the name Aspire for Her because for me, it is, I have enough aspirations, but she doesn't. So I'm going to aspire for her sake. So that was the first thing that caught my attention. And I had a very broad smile on my face when I read it for the very first time. So tell me how Aspire for Her was born.
So happy to hear that. And thank you so much for following our work, Rashmi. It truly, truly means a lot. Aspire for Her essentially is for everyone, whether you're a her or a him, to aspire for the other person. It is about women supporting women. It is about men supporting women. And it is about women truly leveraging their potential. And it's very simple. We want every woman in our country either to be in one of the three E's, either in employment, in entrepreneurship, or in education, which leads to one of these two. We want it to be very, very simple, because we feel that financial independence is the cornerstone of all other forms of independence for women. So we're not trying to solve a social problem. We're not trying to make sure that, you know, men and women have, you know, equal rights. And, you know, societal construct, we want women to be economically independent. We want them to have the financial power to do what they want without depending on anyone else. That's it. So it's simple. We like to keep it this way. We don't want to talk about unpaid labor. We do not want to talk about 135 years to get equality. So it's not social. It's not political. It's not anything else. It is just about women being a force in the economy. And we feel this is a $1 trillion opportunity for our country, for our country's economy.
When you set out on this journey, Madhura, especially when you decided you're going to go ahead with Aspire for Her, your idea was to get women back in the three E's. But how did you put your first steps out there? And how did you look around for support? What exactly did you tell the world around you? And who were there holding your back?
Well, I think the first place that I went to was my XLRI girls group. And I said, you know, this is what I'm planning to do. You know, this is very different from what women's empowerment pieces that we see all around us. What do you guys think about it? And all my friends jumped up and said, this is exactly what we need. We want to give back at this point in time. And we don't know how to, we don't know where to. So we'd love for you to do this. So I got a little encouraged and I started sort of working on putting the pieces together around Aspire for Her. At that point in time, our piece was very simple. We wanted to get women into the economy. And we didn't really, I didn't really have too much of a clue as to how exactly I was able to, I would be able to do that. Unfortunately or fortunately, and you will be speaking about COVID, I know. Unfortunately or fortunately, at that time, 8th of March 2020 is when we launched. So I was in Boston at that point in time, and I had just flown in because I wanted to spend the spring break with my daughter. You know, at that time, the pandemic was just about taking its you know, its first steps, and wondering what this whole thing is. Is it really even something to worry about? Little did we know that you know, it would bring the world to its knees for so many months together. I was creating all the websites and I was approving all the creatives, etc., on the flight. So I was using the Wi-Fi on the flight to actually sort of approve on all the stuff that Aspire for Her was doing. And we landed. And on 8th of March, we launched Aspire for Her, which was a multi-country launch, if you like. So my friends from various different parts of the world, they logged in. And I think it was 6 p.m. India time. And we just launched it. My daughter, serendipitously, was with me at that point in time. You know, she said, you know, let's sort of put out a little form so that everybody who's interested in joining Aspire for Her also comes and joins the community. And I said, that's a great idea. And she did that. She put out that form. And the next day at breakfast, she says, you know what, we've got only 10 people who have logged in and who joined in. And they all seem to be my friends. I said, thank you. Please say thank you to your friends. And, you know, a lot of her friends actually came. And over the next few days, we realized that a lot of her friends, people around her age, were going through a very difficult time because their colleges were shutting down. Their exams were getting canceled. You know, all their plans were getting postponed. And they were in a very, very sort of a ambiguous and a sort of a very difficult juncture in their lives. A lot of them then said, you know, hey, we want to help you. We want to help you build Aspire for Her. So the first team of Aspire for Her that I had was my daughter and her friends. So in fact, our the head of content was one of our friends called Anusha Subramaniam. Anusha was one of the youngest authors of India. She wrote her first book when she was 12. And we had a bunch of our other friends who were heading the different departments. And the girls felt very good that they were all getting important portfolios at Aspire for Her. And they did an absolutely brilliant job for the first few months. Soon after that, we realized that there were people across the globe who truly wanted to be part of the movement. And we soon found that there were women from 60 different countries who signed up at Aspire for Her and, you know, who wanted to just walk with us on our journey. So that was my daughter's, you know, sort of contribution to get it started. And then after that, we had a lot of volunteers. We had a lot of folks who got to hear about us from social media and elsewhere. And they came in and said, you know, we'd love to be with you. We'd love to help you. We'd love to walk the talk with you. And that's how it very organically it grew. So yes, that was a role that my daughter had to play, but my mother had to play a role, which was actually even before this. So when I was looking at the data and I was saying somebody needs to do something about this problem, and how come India is absolutely at the bottom in terms of economic participation of women? And, you know, my mother heard me sort of moaning and, you know, complaining about this. And she asked me, so who should do something about it? You want the government to do something? You want society to do something? You want the organizations to do something? You want the corporate world to do something? What are you doing about it? And I said, okay, I get it. Thank you, as always. And that's how my both my mother and my daughter had a very important role to play in the setting up of Aspire for Her.
Wow. One was the reason for setting it up. The other made sure that you took the first steps forward to make sure that Aspire for Her really had life breathed into it. And then on, as you moved forward, now when COVID hit, a lot of us were in a state of shock. And here you were launching such a big dream of yours and COVID hit. It was like you're going to take it one step at a time. Okay, my daughter's friends have signed up, so we'll work with them first and then take it forward. Nowhere did you stop and say, should I relaunch it again after things get better? Nothing like that.
No, I never had that. I never had that feeling because I felt COVID was a boon to us. Because all of these youngsters who were sort of feeling a lot of pain, feeling a lot of anxiety at that point in time, they decided that they wanted to convert their pain into purpose. And, you know, we would have never got their bandwidth, their undivided time and attention had it not been for COVID. Because they would have been busy doing 10,000 other things with their lives. And here they were, holed up at home, not able to even complete classes, not knowing what's going to happen next in terms of examinations and semesters starting or not starting. Many of them were taking a gap year because they realized that, you know, it was just so uncertain. The world was so uncertain. So that's how I actually got a lot of brilliant minds to work with us and to sort of design the first few steps of Aspire for Her. And that's the reason why I think COVID turned out to be very interesting for us. And it turned out to be a boon. We had never foreseen that boon, but it did turn out to be a boon for us in many different ways.
Wow. I you know, Madhura, I really believe in the power of positivity. And I believe optimism is something that helps you see a bigger picture than what is visible immediately. And it's very clear you are exactly the epitome of both optimism and positivity to just see how to take it forward rather than take a step back. Now you moved, these youngsters came in, everything just fit in like a team. And as you moved further, once things started slowly getting back to normal, how did Aspire for Her grow and what exactly was the journey? The three E's, how did they come into play?
You know, like I said, you know, I'm notorious for models and structures. So we do have a mindset change model, which we sort of came up with. And, you know, that's stolen from a much more famous formula. It's called E cubed is equal to MC cubed. E cubed, you know what it stands for? The three E's of employment, entrepreneurship and education, which leads to one of these two. And MC, C and C are the four critical success factors. And we have not wavered from this model from day one of our existence. M is for mentors and role models. And, you know, we have more than 250 women leaders who walk with us on this journey, who do one-to-one and one-to-many mentorships at Aspire for Her. Because 4 out of 5 girls in India have no successful, relatable, professional woman role model in their immediate network. The next pillar is C, and we call it courses, cohorts, and learning. Here we work on skilling, upskilling, and reskilling women for the jobs of tomorrow's India. And whether it's Amazon or Google or LinkedIn or IBM, etc., we have partners like this who are brilliant in their own vision of wanting to attract more diversity to the talent pools. And you know, we've been very fortunate in getting their support in this. The third pillar is what we call career previews and resources. That's another C. And this is where we celebrate women and their careers. So if you see our social media every day, we have a celebratory story of either a woman leader or a woman who's undertaken some kind of a perilous journey or has overcome many challenges and adversities to actually get to her career. All our success stories are about women and their careers because we are very, very focused on the economic participation of women. And the last C is community. And you know that our community motivates each other, elevates each other, and also tries to find solutions creatively and collectively. We today have 16 communities. We have about 250,000 members, mentors, and supporters that Aspire for Her. And these 16 communities are unique in their own different ways. So we work on a particular agenda with each community. It could be around women in technology, and that's with Amazon and Google and IBM. It could be around women returning to the workforce. And, you know, we have more than 25,000 women who are wanting to return to the workforce, and we're working with multiple organizations to make that happen. So the model that we have sort of created has been welcomed not only by our members, but also by the corporate and the institutional world. And that's what we love about the journey of Aspire for Her, because we know that it's kind of universal. It has an appeal not only for the members who are part of the community and who want to get back into the workforce or get into the workforce, but also for the corporates who are desperate for diversity and who want to welcome more women into the workforce. So it's a sort of a beautiful flywheel that we see emerging every day, and that motivates us, that energizes us every day.
That's so true, because we are talking diversity and inclusion, but when we exclude allies from our journey and community, it doesn't meet its purpose. So how important are the allies for you, especially in Aspire for Her? Because the more diverse the mentors, the more inputs that you have are richer. So how did you collect your mentors? How did you bring them on? And were they willing allies to the community that you have?
So when we say allies, we actually mean men and folks who identify as men as part of our community. We have some wonderful male allies who have been with us, and we would not have been able to do what we have done without their support. That includes people like you know, the very young gentleman who actually was part of our Not Alone community. And he decided that every day at 9 p.m., he would actually sit down and ensure that all the members of our Not Alone community were given adequate resources around finding jobs, finding employment, finding entrepreneurship opportunities, and just helping them out. So this is, you know, we had a set of wonderful male allies, and I'm just giving one example here, who did so many things like this. Or like, you know, the elderly ex-CEO of an organization who decided that, you know, I will just come in and pick up the educational costs of this young woman who was not even able to finish her school because her father had left the family in huge debt, you know, as he had passed away due to COVID. So many of these male allies who came to us at Aspire for Her, and they continue to walk with us in this journey, have been absolutely invaluable, you know, in their support and in also motivating us to do something more. But coming back to your question on mentors and how did the mentors come about in Aspire for Her, as I said, the first time when I talked about it in my XLRI girls group, a lot of mentors came in from there. They put their hand up and said, hey, we'd love to be part of this movement. And they were. But very soon, I didn't really have to ask anybody to become a mentor. In fact, people came up to us and said, hey, we'd love to be part of Aspire for Her. How does one become a mentor? And that continues to the day. I have a lot of folks who come to me and sort of ask me as to how I can contribute, how they can become a mentor, and how they can become a part of Aspire for Her. And it is my pride and privilege to be able to show them the various paths in which they could contribute. Not everyone becomes a mentor, but a lot of them do. They play stellar roles in Aspire for Her, doing various things. So, you know, some of them can, you know, pick up a particular track and completely choose to lead it. Some of them can actually launch a new community and choose to build the community with us. You know, some of them come in and help us with various critical factors, which we perhaps can't always put our arms around. So they help us with strategic matters. They helped us with functional expertise. And I think it's just too many ways to recount. So the kind of support that we've got from the mentor community and the male allies has been absolutely outstanding. And I am truly, truly grateful for all of them being part of our journey.
Yeah, I'm having goosebumps and tears, Madhura, listening to this. Because now for a second, if you pause and meet your 18-year-old self, who publicly declared that she's going to do something for women, what is it that you think your 18-year-old self is going to tell you?
Miles to go before you sleep. See, I don't think we've even scratched the surface of the problem that we're trying to solve. It's a huge problem. It's a wicked problem. It's got multiple elements, and the solutions are not easy. Have we found all the solutions? Absolutely not. Have we tried to sort of, you know, put our arms around the problem? Absolutely, yes. But there is a long way to go. We will only rest, and we have an incredibly motivated, incredibly passionate team at Aspire for Her. We will only rest when we see the trajectory of women in the workforce going up, and after we add 1 million women to the workforce. I think we should allow ourselves a little celebratory pause once we reach the number of 1 million. But as you know, that we're still very far away. And I never let my team forget it. My team also did not let me forget it.
Okay. And I'm sure you stop for some a drink break or an eating break at some point of time. So in the break time, are there moments that you recollect and get more energy, stories of people who've come to you and shared how much Aspire for Her meant for them?
I think that energizes us every day, Rashmi. I think that's what gives us the power, the energy, the motivation to trudge forward and to take and to meet yet another day head on to solve this problem. You know, whether it is the young person who sort of tells us that, you know, she thinks that Aspire for Her is the wind beneath her wings, and she has come out of a small place near Patna. And today she is dreaming of working with a multinational organization because she has seen them at Aspire for Her, and she feels that she can aspire for bigger things in life, not just, you know, become a wife and a mother like the other members of her family. We feel energized when some of our Not Alone members come up and tell us that we have given them a reason to live. Today they're doing well for themselves. They are not only financially independent, but they have transitioned out of that intense grief and that emotional devastation that they were going that had gotten into in that very, very tragic aftermath of COVID snatching away their close ones. And we feel very motivated, we feel energized, because their life, they attribute to us, you know, their new lives and the transformation that they see in their own professional lives. There was a LinkedIn session that we had done just after COVID. And this is a Zoom session like this. And, you know, it's a very simple thing, right? We keep on doing LinkedIn sessions and we tell people how to build LinkedIn profiles, etc. And here was a person from LinkedIn who was doing that. And on the chat, one of our members suddenly mentioned that, you know, my life is at a very tragic point. I lost my husband. I really don't know what it is for me to go forward. And should I at all go forward or not? Or is this the end of the road for me? And it was just a chat. And I saw that and we stopped. And the LinkedIn coordinator, the moderator stopped, the trainer stopped. And all of us just said, hey, you know what? We just want to spend a second with you. And we all put up little hearts like this. And the entire screen lit up with hearts. And that was that. And we went ahead. And a few months later, I got a call from her, the same person. And she said, you know, that moment was the turning point of my life when you guys all put up your hearts on the Zoom screen. I said, wow, how? And she said, I started creating my LinkedIn profile. I started looking for jobs. I found the job of my dreams and I'm joining tomorrow. So I was like completely, you know, overwhelmed, because I never realized that that small act of just putting a small heart out there for her and everybody doing it at the same time would truly make her feel that she was not alone and she had something to look forward to in life. This is just one story, Rashmi, and there are many stories like this. We feel incredibly fortunate to be part of so many stories.
Yeah, I completely understand how it must be feeling, Madhura. Here, I would like you to take a pause and tell us about the pandemic. Yes, Aspire for Her was born and thrived in the pandemic. But personally, for you, what are some of the reflections when you look back? What is it that you take from the pandemic?
You know, obviously, like everybody else, it's completely unexpected. But, you know, after the pandemic hit, you know, one of the strongest reactions that I had, and that it was a very personal moment of reflection for me, was when I was trying to put together a WhatsApp message for the family of one of my friends, my classmates, who had lost his life due to COVID. And I was talking to the wife. This was after a few days after he passed away. And, you know, we were all, as classmates, trying to put together a corpus for the child's education. He didn't leave too much of savings, and we felt that it would be only, you know, a worthwhile thing for us to do. And I called the wife and I said, "Hey, I'm just composing a WhatsApp message. Can you please tell me your bank account number?" It was a very transactional conversation. And she stopped for a bit and said, "You know what? I don't know if I have a bank account or not. These are people like you and me." I was absolutely jolted. I realized that there are many women like her in our country who are absolutely oblivious to any financial matters, whether the husband has passed away, whether they have savings, whether they have investments, whether they have enough money to have the next meal, whether they have a huge credit card debt, or whether they have a huge loan hanging on their heads, whether the house belongs to them or not. They have absolutely no clue. And this was a moment of truth for me, because at that point in time, I decided we have to build a community to ensure that these women who have been left behind in COVID are also made financially independent. We cannot talk of financial independence of women if we do not take these women into our stride. And that's how Not Alone was born. That was one of our communities. It was born exactly 2 years ago, after the brutal second wave. And after I had this conversation, which truly, you know, made me rethink on a lot of things in life. And our Not Alone community went on to welcoming a lot of women who had lost their primary breadwinners. And I'm very happy to tell you that all of them, Rashmi, all of them today are financially independent.
That's absolutely powerful. How did you do that? You just gave them inputs on what they should do? Because LIC claims that there are so many unclaimed claims there in LIC itself, because the next of kin don't even know that the breadwinner had a policy that they were paying premium.
Exactly. I mean, insurance is just one part of the story. Yeah. And many insurance companies also refuse to pay the claims because, and they, in fact, in some cases, they also sued the claimants, saying that, oh, you know, this is not covered. And the claimants, not knowing, you know, the nitty-gritties of the financial world, did not even have the ability to sort of fight back. In many cases, the insurance premium was paid after the person passed away, because the women did not know that you actually get money from the insurance company after the person passes away and decide. I mean, that is the level of financial illiteracy in our country, especially among women. Also among men, in fact, I have to say that. So after we started the Not Alone community, we actually used the same principles of E-cube is equal to MC cube. So we used our mentors in a very different way. Our mentors were not just mentors, they were anchors. In many cases, the anchors would be completely, completely walking with the member on her journey. And they would try to help in every possible way. In one case, one of our anchors, late in the night, after midnight, suddenly saw a message, a WhatsApp message from her mentee saying, "I don't think my life is worth living anymore. I'm going to end it all." Within a few seconds, the message was deleted. And she could not therefore tell anybody, especially her mentee, that she had seen the message. And she called all of us, the core team, and said, "What do we do now? Because this is a mental state that she is in, and she is able, she may actually move on to doing self-harm. And what do we do?" We actually got a whole series of resources in place for Not Alone, thinking, you know, with the best of whatever we could manage to think of. And one of the resources was actually a mental health practitioner and a company which looked at mental health. And, you know, we actually got them involved. in a very, very tactful way. I think our anchor did a fantastic job of a very tactful sort of an intervention to say, hey, you know what? We think that many of the folks who had gone through this kind of journey would love to also talk to somebody who will take care of your mental health. Why don't you have a conversation? Thankfully, the mentee agreed. And today, she actually chose one among three jobs that she was offered. She has professionally done very well for herself. She's looking at changing that first job and she's looking at moving into the next one. But this is how her journey started. That's the way we did it. Not only mentors and anchors, but we had a lot of learning opportunities because everyone was at a different point in time. Some of them had never worked in their lives before. Some of them had worked and then given up professional careers. And some of them were just very, very depressed. So we looked at insurance. We looked at PF. We looked at loans and investments. We looked at legal aid because a lot of the in-laws were turning them out of the house, saying that you do not have any legal right on this house anymore. Therefore, there were a lot of these kind of dramas and complexities being played out. Many organizations mentioned that they would like to help by offering jobs to the women, but very few of them actually translated this into reality. So we did have very, very few organizations that really came forward. But one organization and one of our partners that I would really like to laud for their work on the Not Alone community is Bayer, the German crop sciences firm. They actually lost 12 employees to COVID. And they were people from across different parts of the country. And they told us, we would love to sponsor your Not Alone community and please take care of the families of these 12 employees that we have. And that's exactly what we did. And I think it became a case study in their annals as well. So it was a very, very beautiful intervention. Thanks to them, we managed to do what we could do for Not Alone.
You know, that the purity of intent was absolutely pure and the supreme force has been with you, giving you all the support from all the right quarters at the right time to just lift you and aspire for her and the entire team to do the meaningful work that you're doing. Life lessons are
Thank
a plenty,
you so.
I'm sure, from all the experiences that you're sharing. But if there are three life lessons that you would like to leave us with, what would the three be?
Actually, only three words I'll leave you with. And the three words are aspire for her. Thank you.
You know, the ones who actually work speak very less. The work speaks for them. Humility is an integral part of people who are absolutely secure. And you are one of those. Honored to have had you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Madhura, God bless you and your entire team and the aspirations that you're having for the hers in the world. We will aspire for her for sure. And we are there to support you in any which way that you seek. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rashmi. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you. Great honor. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.